Hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special Rest is History bonus podcast. I have absolutely brilliant news for you. That news is that Tom Holland is on holiday in Corfu and sadly will not be able to join us. So if you were tuning in hoping for more of Marilyn Monroe's top hits, you're going to be cruelly disappointed. But the even better news is that Tom is not here. So top podcasting wizard, Tony Pasta, who is the... Basically, you're the boss, aren't you, Tony? You're the big man, the generalissimo of Goalhanger.
Well,
podcasts.
You know, we don't believe in big man history, do we? We're a very flat organization where we're all able to give each other ideas and, you know, criticize each other's thoughts. So, I work for Goalhanger Podcasts, and we make, as well as the rest is history, we make the rest is politics, and we have ways of making you talk and empire, which I know many people who listen to this pod enjoy.
I've never heard of any of those other podcasts, but I'm happy to believe that you do them.
I do. Given that Tom's not here, do you think we should kick off by talking about him and specifically quoting some of the extraordinary criticism of his incredible impersonation of Marilyn Monroe?
So, yes, he... Tom and I always, as you may know, so Tony, as you will definitely know, when we started out, you used to write our introductions for us, didn't you? You used to write these very, very Alan Partridge-esque sort of local radio, hospital radio style introductions.
I think that's grossly unfair. I am still smarting at the hurt incurred by your comments at the time.
After about a dozen of those, you just lost interest in us completely because you were you had eyes only for Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart. So we started writing our own introductions, and Tom and I will usually bicker quite badly about the introductions because we'll both have crafted what we think of as very funny, amusing introductions. And Tom said he was absolutely desperate to do this Marilyn Monroe. When he said that, he said, "I want to introduce Marilyn." I knew that it would be something unsavory. And I thought, because I thought some people will think Marilyn's quite a trivial subject, so I think with this, we shouldn't have a frivolous introduction. But he was so stubborn, as you know, Tony. Tom, when he gets an idea fixed in his head, he'll ring you 10 times a day about it, and never leave you alone, and he's like a limpet.
He's obsessed with trying to get a mead manufacturer from South London to become our major sponsor, right. Even though they've probably got about 50 quid spare in their PR budget. And he will not leave me alone about it. I've actually asked the mead company if they'd like to sponsor the pod, and
they said no.
even then, they're not interested.
Yeah. Tom is. I think it's fair to say when he gets something stuck in his head, there's no dislodging it. And Tom is also a great man for... Does he phone you a lot, Tony?
He phones me a fair amount, yeah. He only lives up the road, so...
I think this is... Because he's gone away, this is the first kind of three-day stretch I've had for about 18 months where Tom hasn't rung me. And it's like a liberation.
this is the equivalent for you of being an American GI in Vietnam, and you've got a week on the beach, out of the jungle, away from the helicopters.
Exactly. Anyway, Tom wanted to do his Marilyn Monroe, and I thought it would be, you know, I thought I'll let him do it. That's fine. But obviously, when I heard it, I think I physically, you know, I physically cringed. I physically recoiled. And I did think afterwards, will Dom edit that out? Will he ring me quietly and say, do you want to record a separate introduction? But no, obviously, Dom just thought, let him hang himself. Let him do this Marilyn Monroe, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And he did it with such... I mean, Tom loved it. He was absolutely, you know, he thinks... He's there in Corfu right now, Tony. And he thinks he did a brilliant job with that Marilyn Monroe song.
Well, I think the only fair thing to do now is, you know, the only democratic thing to do would be to quote some of the people on Twitter who have enjoyed it. And I think we should start with Henry Lloyd, who very kindly said...
I mean, he's the only one, I think.
I personally rated it. Marilyn Tom Rowe. Yeah. Very good. Like that.
Very good.
Alfie three times said, I'm burning my copies of Persian Fire, Dominion, In the Shadow of the Sword, and Rubicon.
Yes.
Joe Keane, it was like a goose honking in a bathtub.
Yeah.
And Stephen Clark, Why is Carl Stromberg, the villain from The Spy Who Loved Me, singing about diamonds?
That was very good. Yes. Robert Colville, who runs a think tank, a centre-right think tank, he just put out his tweet just read, Jesus H. Christ. And Rory Cathlon-Jones, who was the BBC's, I think he was their media correspondent, was he? He put a message on Twitter saying, I've asked my therapist for an urgent appointment after listening to that.
Well, I've got an extraordinary, outrageous, cynical thought about this, Dominic. Do you think Tom, who has voiced a couple of, intriguing messages for sponsors offering help to people who perhaps could benefit from the time of a therapist. Do you think this is a virtuous circle in which he's actually intentionally created some kind of demand. Distress in the community?
Yeah, I think absolutely.
In Tom order is, to as we know, Tony, numbers.
Tom has eyes only for his bank balance. And I think for all the talk of Christianity, you know, there's only one thing motivating Tom Holland. And I think it's exactly that. He's creating the demand for the very product that he's keenest to advertise. So it's that and Mead, basically. It's people drowning their sorrows or people turning to professional help having listened to his impersonations.
Which presumably they then drink biscuit tea while
they
having that.
They would drink biscuit tea. Yeah, he's very, he loves session. All that, doesn't he? He absolutely loves it. Absolutely. Nobody is keener on the endorsements than Tom. Unbelievable.
No, and it, you know, remarkable the way that just taking some green powder in the mornings has helped him become such an outstanding cricketer.
That's right. Yeah. So I was doing an event on Sunday, Tony.
Yeah.
At Windsor, at the Windsor Book Festival.
This wasn't Royals related, was it?
It wasn't Royals related.
You weren't coaching the young princes or anything.
I wasn't, but I'm available. I was promoting my Adventures in Time books. And actually, I have to say, some members of the Rest is History Club came along. So let me try and think. The Brogan Savage was there. There was a couple of other kind of familiar faces and sort of familiar names. And afterwards, I was signing books. And this family came up. And there were two twins. And the dad said to the twins, go on, tell him what you say in the car. He'll love this. And the girl said, they're about 9 or 10. And the girl said, when I'm in the car and I'm chatting, and we're chatting, my brother keeps on interrupting me. He's always interrupting and butting in. And I say to him, stop interrupting me. You're just like that Tom Holland from The Rest is History. And I thought, that's so true.
Could you imagine if we put the first episode out, that the famous missing first episode?
So I am actually in the room in that first episode, but I think that there's very little audio, because at every moment that I tried to say anything, Tom then gave another 10-minute lecture, didn't he?
Do you think there might be a point at which our members would appreciate the kind of the lost episode of The Rest is History as a private, never for public consumption piece of content?
I think that would come with so many health warnings, though. And I'm just worried that would put people off forever, aren't you?
It might.
That once they've heard that, they can never unhear it.
No, it's true, but it also shows, you know, old dogs, new tricks, willingness to learn, all that kind of thing.
Makes us look flexible and, puts us in a, shows us in a good light, how much we've changed and grown. Yeah, maybe. How much we've educated ourselves, Tony.
I have to say, by the way, I am a massive fan of The Rest is History, as well as being in the production team. And it is my go-to listen on car journeys when running slowly around the common or walking the dog. So I should just say, I thought the Marilyn Monroe episode was great, great fun, but also really, really instructive and interesting. I mean, the thing that stood out most to me as a listener was this point about the fact that she was a film star who didn't really star in films that anybody knows anymore. It's become...
So this got a bit of pushback, actually. Of our listeners, looking here at the notes, so David Pulsford said some of the early films stand up. Lynn Powell was sticking up for How to Marry a Millionaire. Relax, OK, said The Misfits, which was pretty much her last film, was a great film. The thing is, I think these are films that... if you're really interested in film history, you've probably seen them. But among the public at large, I don't think Marilyn Monroe's, with the exception of Some Like It Hot, probably, I stick to my guns. I really don't think that among the general public, who are probably, you know, rest is history club members are not necessarily representative of the general public, I would say.
Nope,
and I think among the public at large, Marilyn Monroe's film work is pretty, I mean, she has a kind of afterlife independent of those films, doesn't she? How often do you ever have a conversation with somebody about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes or Niagara? I mean, never, I would say, unless you're a real, real kind of 50s film buff.
I'd agree with that.
Let's be honest, there aren't that many of those.
She lives on as, for many people, as an image, doesn't she? As an iconic image.
Yeah.
You know, the classic blonde, beautiful woman known to have been caught up with the Kennedys. And to, I mean, would people even instantly know her as a film star as opposed to, a very famous woman? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, especially younger people. Because a lot of people, some people said, well, you know, when I was growing up, her films were on a constant loop, kind of daytime TV. I'm sure that's true. But younger people don't watch films that way anymore. I mean, they stream, so they watch something deliberately. They seek it out. They don't watch something because it just happens to be on.
Sure.
So in some ways, they're less likely to see those things. I think she's also, in the public memory, I think she also represents kind of the heyday of America and Americanization. Sort of that sort of world of Coke and Levi's and the 50s and, you know, the point at which kind of American capitalism was furthest ahead of European, because we were all, you know, bombed out after the war. And there's this sort of, even though she, her persona, you might say, I mean, it's obviously very sexy and whatnot, but there's a kind of innocence to it.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, this is America before the fall, before Vietnam, before the assassinations, sort of hedonistic and sort of carefree and all that sort of stuff. And then her death then is the sort of kick starts. It's the kind of chapter one in the sort of the turn towards the dark, and the, you know, you get in the 70s and you get Nixon and Watergate and whatnot. And I think that's how people, you look at Marilyn and, you know, it's the sort of world of the drugstores and the gigantic cars cruising along Route 66 or something. I mean, those are the kind of associations. I would guess that, as it were, ordinary people who are not history buffs or film buffs would bring to Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, and yet, isn't the sort of irony of that, that while that kind of clean-cut, optimistic, innocent, pre-Vietnam image of America that she symbolized, that is the symbol and the image. In fact, her own life shows you that it's all a bit of a lie and a front, and that, you know, that behavior within certain sectors of American society would have included drugs, lots of infidelity, corruption, you know, the mafia, you know, all those things that perhaps we see as endemic in later American society are actually the very components of the behind the scenes part of her life.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a fair point. So when people idealize the 50s or something, they say, oh, this lost, you left your door unlocked and family values and stuff. Of course, it wasn't like that at all. But I suppose you could say that of all images, couldn't you, of celebrities, that there's a degree of contrivance. And there's a kind of darkness and stuff to them. I mean, the other thing that people commented about, I noticed, is speculative psychology. So there was a bit of a discussion, I think, on the Discord about this. So Mark Kerr said, oh, I think this is out of place in a history podcast to be sort of peer into the murky world of somebody's psychology. I actually disagree with that. I think with all great historical characters, I mean, we did this a bit with Ian Kershaw when we were talking about Hitler. Awesome. And merely because Marilyn Monroe's a film star, it doesn't mean that makes it sort of valueless. I mean, I think when you're writing about history, ultimately you're always writing about human beings. And so there's always that temptation to say, whether it's Tom writing about, you know, Julius Caesar, or it's me writing about Margaret Thatcher or Harold Wilson or something, you're always thinking, what makes them tick? How do we, you know, my portrait of them as a character, I mean, this is true on your other podcast, don't you, when people are writing about the Second World War, your portrait of somebody as a character, what you're actually doing is your, you know, you've got, it's as though you've got open on your desktop kind of 20 Word documents all describing that person. Some of them maybe containing letters and things written by that person themselves. And you as the writer are trying to, you're constructing a character out of those fragments, really. And of course, all the time, you're kind of trying to think, were they really like this? What's their personality like? What makes them tick? I mean, there's always a degree, you know, even if you're the most scrupulous kind of cold-blooded historian, I would say there's always a degree of amateur psychology involved with it, as there is in life generally when you're thinking about your friends or your colleagues, or, I mean, when you're managing your team, Tony, you're thinking about what makes different people tick and all that kind of thing. It's like great. Sure. I mean, an analogy that would appeal to you, great football managers have to be amateur psychologists, knowing what motivates certain players.
I would say that the great ones are the great psychologists, really. You know, you think about people like Brian Clough and Shankly.
Alex Ferguson.
Sean Dyche.
Yeah. Sean Dyche. Very good.
although I have, here's my one pushback on this whole thing, which, and by the way, I think the whole speculative psychology bit is brilliant and great fun. I did English at university, and if we started trying to do this type of thing around authors and intention, we'd be absolutely blown away. You know, the old D.H. Lawrence line, trust the tale, not the teller. You know, it's all about the written word and what actually features in a novel or a play or a poem, and forget the author's own life. It's an irrelevance.
That was the trend then, right? That was the trend in literary
criticism. Yeah, this is the 90s, early 90s. And it was a kind of, it was a fascinating idea for me, certainly. You know, I grew up in Lancashire and found myself in a southern university. They were suddenly talking about postmodernism and saying, you know, we don't care what you think about Graham Greene. It's irrelevant what he thought about it. You know, just read the novel and tell us what's in the novel. Never mind the biography of the author himself. It was a mind-blowing moment, really. You know, that professors would say, we just simply don't care what you think of the author. It's an irrelevance to us.
That's only one approach, though, Tony. I mean,
it was a very, very, very popular one in 1990 to 1993, I can assure you.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I do think, though, that I don't always find that very fruitful. So you're writing about, let's say, Graham Greene. Of course, the text exists outside the teller. You can read The Honorary Consul or, I don't know, whatever. Yeah.
Brian Rock.
And I know nothing about Greene's life and just take the text as it is and bring your own, you bring your own layers of meaning to it and all that stuff. On the other hand, sometimes you actually do genuinely want to know why he wrote it and what the context is. And if you're writing about something like Power and the Glory, where you know that he went to Mexico and you know he saw the Cristero War and whatnot, it would seem to be bonkers not to be interested in those things. But that's why I'm not
Absolutely.
That's why I'm not professor of literature at the University of Kiel or whatever alternative university.
No, indeed. Well, I've abandoned that approach, if I ever even adopted it, to such a degree that recently on a family holiday to Vietnam, which was a fabulous adventure, I found myself in Saigon, which, by the way, interestingly, in the north of Vietnam, they told us, oh, stop calling it Ho Chi Minh City, it's Saigon. And when got to Saigon, they told us, no, it's Ho Chi Minh City. So the two ends of the country take a different approach.
Why do you think that is? Because in Saigon, they were kind of brutalized into calling it Ho Chi Minh City, do you think?
I don't know. There's a lot of very interesting things going in Vietnam, which is a brilliant country. And I know it has, I know it has a dictatorship and lots that we don't approve of. But nevertheless, it's a really high functioning nation in which the politicians do not really interfere with people's lives. They don't really tell them how to live. Economically, it looks like a regular capitalist nation. But they've got a few interesting things. So, for example, their relationship with China is really complicated. We went on a little cooking course, and the woman that ran it took us to a market in the morning to pick our vegetables and fruit and seafood to go, you know, before we did a cooking course with the kids. And I said, where do these vegetables come from? She said, they come from Hanoi. I said, really? And she said, well, obviously not really. We don't, but that's what we say when we mean China. But nobody wants to admit that we're importing huge amounts of vegetables from China because of our relationship with China. So everything we describe as being from Hanoi is probably from China. You know, just extraordinary little things that are happening. But what I was going to say about Greene was, as a massive Greene fan, I found a website that would show you all of the locations that appear in The Quiet American. And so I spent an afternoon, you can imagine that the kids chose not to come on this tour. I spent an afternoon touring around what remains in Saigon of the sites Greene used for The Quiet American, which included going into the hotel that he stayed in and persuading the chap behind in the lobby to let me into his room.
Oh my word.
And he did. And the desk he wrote The Quiet American on is still there. The original desk is still there in the window.
See, Tony, that should be one of our Restless History location trips, shouldn't it? That would be brilliant.
If only we could get a sponsor for that. Wouldn't that be wonderful, Dominic?
So if you're listening. The other thing is, I know Tom really doesn't like Graham Greene. So that's even better. That's another reason to do it. because I've mentioned, because I know you love Graham Greene, and I like Graham Greene. I share a birthday with Graham Greene, and we went to the same Oxford College, so I'm bound to like him. But I think he's a brilliant writer and a great window actually into the 20th century. And I mentioned to Tom about this, and Tom was like, it's funny because Tom did a literature degree and he's less keen on doing episodes about authors and novels than I am. I think doing books is a brilliant way to do history.
Oh, absolutely. I actually walk to the office, which we jokingly refer to as Goalhanger Towers, which is in Clapham Old Town. I walk past the house every morning that Graham Greene lived in during the Second World War and in which he wrote The End of the Affair.
Ah.
There's a blue plaque on the house. It's a beautiful, beautiful Georgian townhouse. And I walk past it every day. And as I see the plaque, I then glance to my right and I see the church there on the corner of the common. That is the church he attended and which features in the novel. And then if you look across...
It's Bendix, isn't it, at the end of The Affair?
That's it. And it, yes, it is, absolutely. And if you look across, you can just see the pub that sits inside the common, the windmill, which is where Greene had the affair with the politician's wife.
Yeah.
That is the basis for the story, The End of The Affair.
That's nice. We should do that. We should do something about that in The Rest Is History.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fascinating, Tony.
Yeah.
I think we should, I think it'd be lovely to do some of these things. The interesting thing with Greene is that he's one of those kind of mid-century writers who's become very, very, he has become kind of unfashionable, hasn't he? I mean, do people under the age of 30 read much Graham Greene? And he's not cool in universities because he's kind of a white man and because he's writing quite straight kind of, quite realist kind of fiction. So he's not, trend, you know, he doesn't tick a lot of the sort of the boxes that if you're teaching a literature course you want ticked these days.
I reread Our Man in Havana earlier this summer actually, and it stands up brilliantly, you know. And if you think about some of the tropes of contemporary politics, you know, the post-truth, the made-up fiction, the idea that, you know,
exactly.
the whole idea that there's a spy who invents a missile system that's been in queue. I mean, it's incredible.
It's
that
a Hoover, isn't it? Isn't it a Hoover or something like that? Is he a vacuum cleaner salesman?
Absolutely. Wormold, the central character, is a vacuum salesman based in Havana.
Yeah.
And he's paid to provide information to the British government about what's going on out there. And he takes photographs of the inner workings of his atomic Hoover.
Yeah,
which they believe is a military site being built in the jungles of southern Cuba. You know, this is brilliant. I think it's really stood the test of time. And actually, if you want to come full circle on this and back to Marilyn Monroe and the films nobody watches, well, I was trying to think before we chatted today about the black and white films that have survived, the black and white films that you would say to Arthur if you were in on a Sunday afternoon, oh, the Third Man's on, we should watch this.
We've watched The Third Man. Brilliant choice, yeah.
So the third man, I would say, is one of those black and white films that feels almost timeless, even though it's so timely in that post-war Vienna. You know, I never knew the old Vienna before the war, you know, and in fact it's very much of its day, and yet it's survived and it feels very watchable. Doesn't feel to have dated hugely. My wife last night had a couple of friends around to watch an old movie, and they watched Double Indemnity, Barbara Stanwyck and Fred Moore.
Brilliant
film. Still witty, still sexy. My go-to is The Big Sleep, you know, with Bogart and Bacall, which still, I think, has survived. So I think there are plenty of films from the Monroe era and earlier that have survived, and yet most of hers, I feel I agree with you, haven't really.
No, they're probably just not as good films. I mean, that's the truth of it. I mean, now I know some listeners will disagree, but I think those kind of melodramas or those comedies often don't stand up as well as the kind of more hard-bitten. I mean, the film noirs, Hitchcock, of course, Hitchcock's films, I think, have stood up pretty well. If you think about a black and white film that's incredibly, you can watch it now, not dated at all, Psycho. I mean, Psycho, I suppose, is one of the last great black and white films, isn't it? It's about 1960 or so.
And famously, Hitchcock was asked afterwards why he had shot it in black and white, because color was available.
Yeah.
And he claimed that the shower scene was unfilmable in color. It would be too gruesome. It would be unwatchable for the audience. And that it had been an artistic choice for him to shoot Psycho in black and white.
It does give it the kind of a starkness, doesn't it? And a kind of, in a weird way, a kind of timelessness, I think, black and white photography can work that way. Anyway, Tony, we should press on with some of these other things.
Sorry, of course.
So Hilary Mantel, probably the most famous historical fiction writer of her generation. Now, you're a big literature man. She died last week. Are you a big fan of the Wolf Hall trilogy, Tony?
I'm not, I'm afraid. I haven't read them, which is shameful, right. I know. But what I can tell you is that I saw Alistair Campbell yesterday. We were recording The Rest is Politics with Alistair and Rory Stewart in the flesh. Rory was over for giving a talk in London. And so we got the two boys together, which is not often the case because Rory Stewart is based in Jordan. And so we do an awful lot of it remotely. So we got the two boys together. And the death of Hilary Mantel cropped up in conversation while we were recording the pod. And Alistair Campbell said that Hilary Mantel once claimed that anybody reading the character of Thomas Cromwell should imagine Alistair Campbell with an axe.
Wow. He's just flattering himself for that, I think.
But I have to say he was pretty pleased with the analogy.
I bet he was.
Why do you think they're so popular?
So I read Wolf Hall. I was going to a conference in Texas and in Austin, and I was given a proof copy before it was published to Wolf Hall because I was interviewing her for a books magazine. I did an interview with her and David Starkey together at the Tower of London.
Wow.
About Henry VIII. And somebody said, I'd read her brilliant book about the French Revolution, A Place of Greater Safety, which if anyone hasn't read it, I think is her best historical book anyway. I think her non-historical books, by the way, are even better. So I read this book, I had a massive flight. It's one of those where it was delayed by a couple of hours. So I had this, and it was like, it's a weird analogy, but it was like basically diving into a Christmas pudding. It was such a rich and immersive read.
Was it with brandy butter?
Yeah, exactly. Brandy butter and not custard, Tony.
Quite right, too.
I think the appeal of those books is first of all that it's absolutely, they're completely immersive. So you're in Thomas Cromwell's head, effectively. The whole thing is mediated through Cromwell's consciousness, which is a pretty daring decision given that he's such an anti-hero. And normally when in accounts of that period, he's basically a bad guy, a bit of a thug, Henry VIII's enforcer. So that's part of it. But I think it's also that they're unlike most historical fiction basically degenerates into people talking in this kind of ridiculous, archaic English, thinking things they wouldn't think, you know, because of course the novel by definition is not a form that, let's say, Anglo-Saxons would have used. I mean, Tom and I have talked about this, that when you're reading Bernard Cornwell's books, The Last Kingdom, the real problem is, why is Uhtred of Bebbanburg narrating a story in the style of a kind of 19th century narrator? It doesn't really make sense.
No, of course not.
But with this, there's a, you know, she's telling the story filtered through the consciousness of Thomas Cromwell, but she has this extraordinary gift of making the world of the 16th century feel contemporary. So you don't feel like it's sort of doublet and hose for the sake of it and kind of, you know, jesters with bells, and it all feels kind of fresh, and it has it's very hard to describe, but it has the sort of the smack of modernity about it, that they're living in a new world. You know, she's got all these little details about how they dry the ink and how they, you know, the candles and all these kinds of things. She has a real eye for the tiny telling, the flaking paint or whatever. And I think it's not just that they're great historical novels, it's that they're really, really good novels. They're really the highest class of literature. And it's unusual, actually. I hope listeners don't think they're snobbish, but most historical fiction is just genre fiction. It's just, you know, it'll be out of print in 5 years. But her books, you know, it's unusual for somebody at that level, and pound for pound, a brilliant writer, to be writing historical fiction and taking it so seriously. And when I did this interview with her and David Starkey, I remember it very vividly. We're in the Tower of London in a kind of top room. I think it was Waterston's Books Quarterly. I basically set it up. And it was a photo shoot as well, because we were all going to be in the Tower, and that was the sort of appeal of it. And what really sort of struck me was that she gave Starkey absolutely as good as he got, kind of thing, because she knew the history just as well as he did. And later, after she died, one of the things I read somebody was saying that, you know, 10 years before she published Wolf Hall, she was going to Tudor academic conferences and taking notes at the back of the room, kind of to make sure she got every single detail right of the wardrobe and what they had, but also to sort of understand that world. And actually, this takes us slightly back to the sort of psychology point earlier on with Marilyn Monroe. We all think we know these characters. You know, everybody in Britain basically studies the Tudors at school ad nauseam. So we all think we know Anne Boleyn, Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, all these people. But the truth is, of course, they are kind of unknowable. All we have are kind of fragments. We've created the Henry VIII we want, the sort of fat Stalin sort of character. Mm. But her brilliance was to bring them alive as kind of three-dimensional characters.
And for somebody like me, and I guess I'm probably in a minority of people listening to this who haven't read any Hilary Mantel, where would you start? Where would you recommend that we begin?
That's a great question. So I think the French Revolution book, so A Place of Greater Safety, it's about these, the protagonist is a guy called Camille Desmoulins, who was a sort of revolutionary printer and journalist who was very good friends with both Danton and Robespierre. Again, like the Tudor books, it's completely anchored in an enormous amount of research, but it does a brilliant job of bringing that period to life. And then the other book that I always think of, I think it's Beyond Black. So it's a ghost story, Tony, and it's about a medium called Alison, who is kind of, she's a psychic, but she has all these kinds of, she's haunted by demons, basically. And it's set here and now, it's contemporary, but it is an absolutely stunning piece of writing, stunning, haunting piece of writing. So I really recommend that as well.
Brilliant. I think there's one other thing that we really have to just comment on briefly, or that you have to comment on, and I'll get your view. I saw on Twitter that Ed West posted a graph which suggested that 6% of Americans think they could beat a grizzly bear in a fight.
What?
It caused some controversy amongst the Wangs, you know, not unreasonably. Right. A third of Brits said they couldn't beat a rat in a fight.
Yeah.
And Lee Kuan Yew, respecter, said, no wonder you lost your empire. There's just some extraordinary statistics on here. So, for example, 23% of Americans believe they could beat a large dog in a fight, which I'm
how
interested
big dog?
By.
That's the question.
Well, the word used is large. Yeah. You know, I've got an Airedale Terrier and I definitely wouldn't fancy my chances against her. But most disturbingly, about 8% of Americans believe they would beat a lion
I
in
saw
a
that.
Fight.
Yeah.
Now,
ludicrous.
Now, in what world does that outcome happen? You know, extraordinary. What about the kangaroo? Do you think it's reasonable that about 5% of Brits and about 14% of Americans think they'd beat a kangaroo?
Well, or the king cobra, Tony. Almost 20% of Americans think they would beat a king cobra in a fight. I mean, it's hard to picture that fight, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because what are you, I mean, are you armed? Are you fight unarmed combat with a cobra? I mean, I don't fancy that personally.
Do you know, I've actually not seen, that's not true. I have had a discussion about how to beat a snake in a fight with somebody who knows.
Right.
I was once on holiday in Sri Lanka and we stayed at a house that they kept two black dogs there. And and the dogs were lovely. And, they, even though they rented the house out, the dogs always remained. You had to have the dogs.
Yeah.
And I asked the chap who looked after the house, I said, what's the story with the dogs? He said, well, we get dangerous snakes on the land and the dogs sort them out. I said, how does that work? And he said, well, they have to work in pairs. One dog stands at the front of the snake and distracts it. The other one approaches it from behind and bites it in half.
God almighty.
They work in tandem.
That's not much good to you as a human though, is it, Tony? I mean, I'm not going to bite a snake in half or volunteer to distract it.
No, volunteer to distract a snake. We could get Tom to volunteer to distract a snake.
I was
going to
say, do you see what Dom has written in the chat? He says it's like the rest is history tactic with guests.
I could imagine. Could you imagine if Tom sang in the manner of Marilyn Monroe in front of a king cobra while you attacked it with a machete from behind? That might work.
I mean, irrespective of the attacking with a machete from behind, I would pay good money to see Tom singing Marilyn Monroe to a cobra. I'd love to see that, Danny.
Where do you think that might happen? How could we bring that about?
Yeah,
is that a reality format?
I think that's something we should think about for next year, frankly, when we go on the road. Listen, I think the thing about this is the interesting contrast between American optimism and British pessimism, isn't it?
Pessimism or practicality? How do you see it?
I mean, this is practicality, but there is a sort of more serious point here, which is that it's interesting how two, you know, Anglophone countries, their sort of public culture in America absolutely promotes optimism, a sort of can-do spirit and stuff. And in Britain, we do think poorly of that, don't we? I mean, that is something that we are kind of conditioned to. Our instinct is to undercut. I remember I was talking about this conference in Texas. I think it was that conference that I went to, where about half the people were American and about the other half were Canadians or Brits. Some guy was talking, and this Canadian bloke leaned over to me and said, "He is so American, isn't he?" of this historian. And he was. He was very smartly attired in a blazer with kind of gold buttons, and he had shining teeth. And he basically, you know, he was the kind of man who effectively handed out, sort of metaphorically handed out copies of his CV whenever he met you, in a way that for a Brit would find incredibly kind of
self-promoting
and kind of gauche. Yeah. We would shrink from that. But it obviously works, and it's kind of infectious. That optimism is infectious, but it's not something to which that we, one way or another, have culturally been conditioned to see as alien and, you know, as sort of beneath us, I suppose.
Yeah, I do. But I have to say, I think it carries Americans a long way. And
it does.
You know, as an employer of, you know, 10 or 11 people, I have to say, people who arrive for interviews for jobs or contracts or to work with us or in any way, people who arrive with that sort of American confidence and enthusiasm and a big smile and a can-do people, they're extremely desirable to, you know, in terms of joining your team.
Of course.
People who turn up and are cynical and, you know, a bit downbeat, it's harder to make a case for. I can see how they get on.
Yeah, it's one reason, Tony, actually, why I found it just dispiriting being in full-time academia 20 years ago, was the sort of pervasive culture of negativity and cynicism. Yeah. You know, sort of moaning about the students, moaning about the institution, actually moaning about history, you know, moaning about the subject. There were too many people for me who came in every morning, sort of hangdog, miserable, always looking to undercut everything, always looking to find fault. You know, we would say, I always remember when we'd have historians come applying for jobs, and the sort of lots of members of the department would sit there while these people did their presentation about their research. And even when they knew nothing at all about the subject, the instinct was always, let's find a way of slagging it off and poking holes in it. And I used to sort of think, do you not like history? Are you not interested to hear what these people are doing? And I think it's an issue both in academia, but I think in Britain, kind of those two things, it's a sort of toxic combination of Britishness and academia, so that you become very, very cynical. It's all about sort of knocking things down. It's sort of criticism turned into a kind of aesthetic, I suppose.
I'd agree. Having said that, I think our final observation on this very point should be that, you know, it's one thing to be optimistic, but the 9% of Americans who think they'd beat a gorilla in a punch-up are sadly deluded.
What circumstance are you in, though, where you're having a fist fight with a gorilla?
Well, you know... not a good circumstance.
I mean, maybe that this happens to you in your capacity as a football producer, but not.
I should finish by telling you an outrageously indiscreet story about a near fight I witnessed in my capacity as a football producer. I was in Barcelona doing a Champions League game, and I was walking from the hotel to the stadium in the company of former Manchester United captain Roy Keane.
Oh, that's a surprise.
Yeah, so Roy is an absolutely brilliant bloke. I like him very much. And by the way, hugely misunderstood. So for example, my first time I met him, we were walking through Milan after a game, and he was talking to me about his theories around management. And I said, there's a Canadian sociologist, writer, journalist called Malcolm Gladwell that you'd find interesting. And he said, oh, I've read all his books.
Oh.
I was utterly gobsmacked and showed it. And he said, well, you know, you don't think footballers can read, Canada? You know. It was really interesting. Anyway, so we were walking through Barcelona, heading to the game, and Arsenal were playing. And a load of Arsenal fans in the street had obviously had an extremely good afternoon on the Ramblas, you know, right. as you can imagine. Tapas and alcohol in the sunshine. One of them decided when he saw Roy Keane, former captain of their former great rivals, that he really needed to go and have it out with him. I was with Roy, who was in a smart suit. And the guy abused Roy, and Roy looked at him, and I kind of did the classic thing, you know, getting hold of his arm and going, come on, Roy, just ignore them. Leave it, Roy, it's not worth it. Roy Keane looked at me like I was insane and went, absolutely not. And he walked towards this boy and he stood in front of him and basically said to him, say that again. And the bloke absolutely backed down, apologized and walked away.
You would.
It was a fantastic moment of insight for me, like, you know, they're trying to bully you in the street. He was not having it.
Yeah.
And he would have allowed anything to happen rather than that boy feel he'd had one over on him. It was an extraordinary moment.
So, Tony, we should definitely get him on the podcast and see if Tom dares to interrupt him and see how that goes.
What would his specialist subject be?
Could we get him on to do Anglo-Irish relations? Yeah. I expect he has strong views about that.
He's very interesting on it because he's got five children who were all born in Manchester area.
Yeah.
And one of them once hinted they might support England in a football game. And Roy was quite clear, you are Irish.
Right.
You know, the fact you're born here and lived here all your life is neither here nor there. You are Irish.
What would he do, though, when they have children? Right. I mean, it's going to be very hard to persuade those children that they're also, you know, when their own parents were born and brought up in England and have English accents.
Yeah, but it's this interesting thing about the complexity of identity, isn't
it?
Because
he
likes to see England do well, you know, as far as I can tell. He doesn't wish us badly. He loves living in England, you know. But it's just that he's very clearly Irish. I am Irish. And, you know, where I live is not relevant.
It's much more complicated, isn't it? So my wife is from Cork, like Roy Keane.
Like Roy. Yeah.
And she and her sister Rachel, who's been on the podcast twice,
absolutely.
They were talking about the Queen's funeral. And, you know, they weren't talking about it in a dismissive way. They both watched it all. They enjoyed it. They thought they took it seriously. They doesn't make them any the less Irish, but they live in Britain and they treat British things seriously as we would if we were living in Ireland. I mean, I think people, that sort of slightly cartoonish vision that people had, things are much more complicated, aren't they?
Yeah, the Norman Tebbit cricket test is a complete load of nonsense. And I think we all know that now, don't we? This idea that Asians living in Britain, the great test is, do they support England when they play India at cricket or Pakistan or Bangladesh at cricket? And if they don't, somehow, you know, they're letting down the nation. Well, in fact, of course, it's much more nuanced than that.
Right.
And people have legacy and affection for their parents' place of birth. I mean, I took my three lads to see England play Malta, where one half of my family originates from, Malta. And the boys and I absolutely roared Malta on in the hopeless task of playing England. Doesn't mean I don't love England. Doesn't mean I don't support England. It's just, you know, Malta's got such a key part of my identity. My grandmother grew up there during the war, you know, and married a British soldier. It's a massive part of our family identity. And of course, we're going to go and cheer Malta on. Doesn't mean we're unpatriotic.
Of course, of course. Oh, and that bombshell. So, Tom, if you're listening, he won't be listening, Tony. Actually, he will be listening, knowing him, because he will be gutted not to be doing the bonus episode, because he will hate the thought of Rest Is History happening and him not having some element of control over it.
Well, actually, I have to say, as a producer, I find Tom's approach very gratifying because he listens to everything back and he has sensible observations on it. He says, sometimes I think we got that about right. Sometimes he says, I think we could have done a bit more of this. He's a really good self-analyst, actually, of the content we put out.
Tony, there's an implicit contrast here, which I don't like the sound of.
In contrast, Dominic, I'm not even sure you're aware the podcast exists.
Well, you know, I'm confident that I believe it goes out. I'm confident that people listen to it. Right.
No, I listen. The way you've worked that Twitter feed in the last couple of years, I have to say, you know, it's been professionalism I didn't expect.
Really? What did you expect?
Oh, I expected a kind of, you know, I won't step into that cesspit of social media. But in fact, you've embraced it brilliantly.
Well, I don't do what Tom does, which is basically live tweet my life. I mean, I do draw a line there. I mean, Tom was horrified when I went on it was, I think it was this summer, and he said, will you be promoting the episodes while you're on holiday? I said, Tom, I won't be on Twitter at all. I mean, I'll be on holiday. And it was clear he couldn't quite get his head around how that would work. He was like, how would you not look at Twitter? I said, well, I just won't look at it.
I admire and envy you, because I'm afraid my life is definitely nearer to, I don't tweet my life, but I definitely do not ignore Twitter.
You can't stop following it.
Nope.
All right.
I'm afraid not.
Tony, unbelievably, this is, I think, probably the longest bonus episode we've ever done.
Well, I apologize.
You should come on more often.
I'm sure our listeners would will be relishing the moment when Tom returns from Corfu.
Well, we wish him well. We hope he has a lovely holiday. And what have we got coming up, Tony? We've got I think we've got French films coming up, have we?
So will we have a bit of a Bouda souffle with the Breathless? Because, of course, the director died only last week, did he not?
He did. Godard. Yeah, we're not. There was some Godard, but it wasn't a Bouda souffle. And actually, that's coming in a couple of weeks, French films. So we've got Jane Austen, Fashion in the Age of Jane Austen coming up, and the Young Churchill series, which Tom and I were very excited about. So if you think the Marilyn Monroe impersonation was bad, Tom does a Churchill that I think it's fair to say becomes very decadent. Not Churchill, but Tom's impersonation becomes very decadent as the podcast goes on. Becomes more and more, I don't want to say self-indulgent, but it becomes more and more remarkable. So on that note, we'll probably let you get on with the rest of your lives. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.